Exodus chapter 12 verse 42 to chapter 14 verse 12, the 16th talk in a series on Exodus, was presented by David Crabtree on September 25, 2016 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 14, Exodus 12:42 to 14:12, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we'll be looking at Exodus. So we'll start with the last part of chapter 12, and then we'll go on from there. If you'll recall, there's a little break in the action here that starts in verse 40 and 41 of chapter 12, in which Moses is just pausing and reflecting on the fact that the Israelites were in Egypt a long time and suffering for a long time until God finally acted and had them driven out of Egypt. Now, in the next section, there are going to be two digressions. The first digression is talking about who can participate in Passover. The next digression is going to be the establishment of the third of the spring feasts, the Feast of First Fruits. And then he's going to enter back into the narrative, pick up the action where he left off, and talk about the Israelites then fleeing off into the wilderness. So we'll pick up the action in verse 42, chapter 12 of Exodus. "It is a night to be observed for the Lord, for having brought them out of the land of Egypt. This night is for the Lord, to be observed by all the sons of Israel throughout their generations. And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, 'This is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner is to eat of it, but every man's slave purchased with money, after you have circumcised him, then he may eat of it. A sojourner or a hired servant shall not eat of it. It is to be eaten in a single house. You are not to bring forth any of the flesh outside of the house, nor are you to break any bone of it. All the congregation of Israel are to celebrate this. But if a stranger sojourns with you and celebrates the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near to celebrate it. And he shall be like a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person may eat of it. The same law shall apply to the native as to the stranger who sojourns among you.' Then all the sons of Israel did so. They did just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. And it came about on that same day that the Lord brought the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts." So this is more instruction with respect to the celebration of the Passover. And it starts out saying that this is to be observed this night. The celebration is to be observed for the Lord. And it repeats that two times. This is to be observed for the Lord, for having brought them out of the land of Egypt. This night is for the Lord, to be observed by all the sons of Israel throughout their generations. What's emphasized here is that all the people of Israel are to celebrate this feast, and this feast is to be celebrated for all time, throughout all of the generations. Passover is a big deal, and we'll talk about this more later. Passover is a very big deal, that it is something that God wants them to celebrate annually and remember what happened there. And they are to celebrate, observe it carefully. It says it is to be observed for the Lord. It's to be watched over. It's to be guarded. It's something that is supposed to be celebrated the way that God commanded that it be celebrated, and celebrated conscientiously. Now, in 43, it starts out, and it's talking about, it's a question that is being anticipated by Moses, and that is, who exactly qualifies for this? Who exactly is supposed to celebrate this? Later on, when we get to talking about the law, this has become clear to me talking to my children who have spent some time in Israel, that if you're given the law and you want to follow it seriously, it is going to raise all kinds of questions with respect to definition, exactly what is meant here. So, for instance, the Sabbath. You aren't supposed to work on the Sabbath. Well, what's work? You have to start defining some things, trying to figure out what was intended by the law, and then following it carefully. Well, here the question that's raised is, when it says all are supposed to celebrate it, the question is, all who? And that's what Moses is going on to respond to. What is intended here? It starts out saying, no foreigner is to eat of it. The Passover is intended for the people of Israel and only for the people of Israel. So no foreigner, it's strictly, literally, it's son of a stranger is the phrase that's used here. So no foreigner is allowed to participate in the Passover. Now a slave, if a slave is purchased and he is circumcised, then he can eat it. So one's standing in society doesn't matter. The question is, are they circumcised? Is this person circumcised? If they are, then they can participate in it. If it's a sojourner or a hired servant, so these are people that are passing through. They're in Israel temporarily. A sojourner is someone who is spending time in Israel, but is not a part of Israel. The hired servant is like foreign labor that's in Israel. They are not to eat of it. So those are the people that are not qualified to eat it. 46, it is to be eaten in a single house. You're not to bring forth any of the flesh outside of the house, nor are you to break any bone of it. So in remembrance of what happened on the night of Passover, when they were supposed to stay in their houses while the angel of death passed over, similarly, this is to be eaten in a single house. They aren't supposed to go from house to house. They go into a house and eat the whole meal there in that one house. And none of the food is supposed to be brought out of the house. It's eaten and all consumed. Whatever is not consumed is to be burned up. And you're not supposed to break any bone of it. I am confident that there is symbolism behind both of those things. They're supposed to be eaten in a house and all consumed, and also that you're not supposed to break the bone. But I don't know what the symbolism is. I don't know what it's standing for. And I can say that about a lot of things here in this. I'm confident that these features of the Passover have been carefully selected and are supposed to be preserved by the people of Israel because they all have significance. I just don't know what the significance is in many cases. I did write down in the notes, I found references to a couple of articles where it talks about the broken bones, and I really just put those in so I can remember to go back and find those at some point, but you're welcome if you're interested. Okay, then it's 47, all the congregation of Israel are to celebrate this. So previously the emphasis was on who can't, and now it's on who must, who should. Well, everyone who is of the congregation of Israel is supposed to celebrate it. So in 48, if a stranger sojourns with you, so here is a sojourner, someone from another country who's come and staying in Israel. If they stay and they celebrate the Passover, so they are so identified with the people of Israel that they celebrate the Passover, then they need to be circumcised. And if he does that, then he shall be like a native of the land. So then there's no distinction. Even though they're a foreigner, if they are so identified with Israel as to become circumcised, they are participants in the Passover, and the people of Israel are not to make any distinction between them and the native born. The same law, let's see, but no uncircumcised person may eat of it. The same law shall apply to the native as to the stranger who sojourns among you. Okay. So the principle here seems to be anyone who fully identifies with Israel, they are to celebrate the Passover. Anyone who does not fully identify with Israel, they are not to eat of the Passover. This is a celebration just for the people of Israel. It's distinctive to them. Verse 50, then they went out, the sons of Israel did as they were told to do by Moses and by Aaron. And it is on that day then, when they celebrated the Passover, that very same day is the day that they went out from Egypt by their hosts. So in military array, they leave Egypt. Now, chapter 13 starts with the second of the digressions, and now it's going to talk about the Feast of the First Fruits. It starts out in verses 1 and 2, explaining what the Feast of First Fruits is all about, the basis for it. Then, in verses 3 through 10, it's going to talk about the context in which the Feast of First Fruits is to be celebrated. And that context is the context of the week of Passover, or the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, okay? So it's going to talk about the Feast of the Unleavened Bread as the context in which the Feast of the First Fruits is to be celebrated. And then 11 through 16 is going to talk specifically about the Feast of First Fruits. Okay, now just to make this clear, in the spring then, there are three festivals that are all part of a one-week celebration. The first day is Passover proper. That's celebrating the day when God passed over the firstborn of Israel, and yet he killed the firstborn of the Egyptians. So that's the first day of the week. But the whole week, the whole 7 days, is referred to as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And that's the period of time during which every day is a Sabbath, and during that week, no unleavened anything is supposed to be eaten. Then sometime during that week, and it's unclear which day it is, but one day during that week is the Feast of First Fruits, when they do what's said at the end of this chapter. So there are three feasts, separate feasts, celebrated during 1 week. And Passover and the Feast of First Fruits both occur during that week, which is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Okay? And by the way, it starts on Passover, and this becomes clear in Deuteronomy, there is supposed to be a assembly of what is called a holy assembly of the people of Israel. They're all supposed to come together and celebrate Passover, part of Passover, on the Temple Mount. And then there's also supposed to be a holy convocation on the last day of the week. So those are bookends on this week. I will point out something that I find interesting, and again, it's something I can't explain. I don't know the answer to it, but as Passover is first laid out, it is essentially a family celebration. It is celebrated by household. But as is laid out in Deuteronomy and as is practiced in Israel, it is partly celebrated by the household and partly celebrated as a national holiday, a national festival. So on Passover day, they take their Passover lamb to the Temple Mount and they sacrifice the lamb at the temple. And then when it has been placed on the altar and that sort of thing, afterwards they take the lamb home and they eat it in their homes. So it becomes a blending of a household festival and a national festival. But initially it's a household festival. Okay? All right. Chapter 13, verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Sanctify to me every firstborn, the first offspring of every womb among the sons of Israel, both of man and beast, it belongs to me." So that's the basis for which the Feast of First Fruits is celebrated. Every firstborn is uniquely dedicated to God. Presumably, in this context, that's true, because what happened on Passover is God went through Egypt and killed all of the firstborn. He took them all. The only ones that were spared were those for whom a lamb was killed and blood from the lamb was put on the doorposts and the lintels. On the basis of that, then, the firstborn was spared. God could have taken them too, but he didn't. On the basis of the lamb's blood, they were not taken. And I assume that that's the basis for it saying, it belongs to me, that is, the firstborn belongs to me, that the firstborn is uniquely devoted to God. Verse 3, "And Moses said to the people, 'Remember this day in which you went out from Egypt, from the house of slavery. For by a powerful hand, The Lord brought you out from this place, and nothing leavened shall be eaten. On this day in the month of Abib, you are about to go forth. And it shall be, when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall observe this rite in this month. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten throughout the 7 days, and nothing leavened shall be seen among you, nor shall any leaven be seen among you in all your borders. And you shall tell your son on that day, saying, it is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt. And it shall serve as a sign on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead, that the law of the Lord may be in your mouth. For with a powerful hand the Lord brought you out of Egypt. Therefore you shall keep this ordinance at its appointed time from year to year. So now, like I said, this is the context in which the festival of first fruits is to be celebrated, and that context is during the week of unleavened bread. And what is stressed here is the importance of remembering this festival, this feast, and why it was commanded for them to celebrate it. And the reason that they are to celebrate it is because this was a time in history when God acted overtly on behalf of his people. He reached down into human history and acted very demonstrably on behalf of his people. It says, you went out from Egypt, from the house of slavery, for by a powerful hand the Lord brought you out from this place. That phrase, that with a powerful hand God brought you out of slavery in Egypt, is going to be repeated 3 or 4 times. In this chapter, that's what they are supposed to remember. The significance of the Passover is God acted powerfully and demonstrably in history in a way that shows that he has complete control over history, and he acted on their behalf to save them. The problem, the reason that this is brought up, is because what it's being anticipated is once they get into the promised land, and their enemies are defeated, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, when all these people that are now occupying the promised land are defeated, and the Israelites are settled there, and in this land flowing with milk and honey, then it's going to be all too easy for them to forget what it is that God did for them. It'll be all too easy for them to take for granted the gifts that God has given them. That's why it is so important for them to remember to celebrate this faithfully every year. The significance of unleavened bread, I'm not sure what that is. So again, I'm sure it's symbolic. And the question is, what is it symbolizing? Earlier, it was pointed out that it's unleavened because they had to eat quickly. But as the rabbis point out, it was in the Egyptian Passover, it was only the first day that we know that they ate unleavened bread. After that, it isn't mentioned. So I'm not sure what all the significance of unleavened bread is, but I'm sure it's significant. There is to be no leaven among them at all for that week, for that period of time. It is traditional in Jewish families on the day before Passover for the head of the household to say a prayer, then light a lamp, and then go everywhere in the house looking for leaven to see if there's any leaven any place in the house. And if any is found, then that leaven is removed and it is burned outside the house. So that the tradition, it's a great little picture, I think, but they're taking seriously this requirement that all leaven is supposed to be removed from the house. Verse 9, and it shall serve as a sign to you on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead, that the law of the Lord may be powerful in your mouth. I'm sure you're all aware that some Orthodox Jews wrap phylacteries on their hands and on their forehead in obedience to this requirement. But what is suggested by some commentators, and I think this is not unlikely, is that what's being talked about here when it says, serve as a sign to you on your hand and as a reminder on your forehead, that what it's being stressed here is this celebration is to remind you of what God has done, in particular what he did in bringing you out of Egypt. And this will serve as a reminder of that fact. So when it says a sign on your hand or a reminder on your forehead, it's like what we would do tying a ribbon around our finger, or some people do that or used to do that. But tying a ribbon on your finger is a way of reminding you that there was something you were supposed to remember. I think the modern equivalent is to write something on your palm, or probably put something in your cell phone. But this is to remind you of what it is that God did on your behalf when he brought you from Egypt. Okay, verses 11 through 16. Now it shall come about, when the Lord brings you to the land of the Canaanite, as he swore to you and to your fathers, and gives it to you, that you shall devote to the Lord the first offspring of every womb, and the first offspring of every beast that you own. The males belong to the Lord, but every first offspring of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. But if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And it shall be when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? Then you shall say to him, with a powerful hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. And it came about when Pharaoh was stubborn about letting us go, that the Lord killed every firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore, I sacrifice to the Lord the males, the first offspring of every womb. But every firstborn of my sons I redeem. So it shall serve as a sign on your hand and as phylacteries on your forehead. For with a powerful hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt. So now it's talking about the Feast of First Fruits, specifically what is supposed to be done. And again, it starts out with that preface talking about when God brings you into the land where the Canaanites are. Once again, this is a land that's occupied by people, and this is a people, there are several peoples living there, and they are formidable. They are military forces to be reckoned with. They're there right now, but God is going to bring the Israelites to that land, and he is going to help them drive out the Canaanites and give the land to them. So what Moses is saying is, when that happens, when he puts you in the land, into the land that is now occupied by the Canaanites and looks like you can't have it, and when he gives you the land that he swore to your fathers a long time ago, when he keeps that promise, then it will be important for you to keep this festival of first fruits, because otherwise you're going to take everything that God has done for you for granted. And what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to take the firstborn of all of your livestock, the firstborn male, and that firstborn male is to be sacrificed to God, given as a sacrifice. If, however, that firstborn is to a donkey, so we're talking about big livestock animals, if that's the case, then you are allowed to redeem it. That is to say, you can give a lamb as a sacrifice in its place. You don't have to kill it. But if you choose to kill it, then you can do that instead. You have that option. But for every one of your sons, you must sacrifice a lamb, redeem that son, much as happened in Egypt at the Passover. And once again, we've seen this several times. It is intended that this be an educational opportunity, that they are instructed to pass on to their children why it is that they are celebrating these, commemorating these events. And once again, what's said is, then you shall say to him, with a powerful hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. That's essentially the same thing that is said in each case. That's what they need to remember. Then it goes into more detail explaining what happened and why it was that God killed the firstborn of the Egyptians and let those of Israel go. Okay. Okay, so that's the end of the two digressions. So now the narrative is going to pick up where we left off. And where we left off, as you will recall, the Israelites had fled out of Ramesses, the city where they had been, and they took off towards Sukkot. And in the notes that I sent out, there's a map, and you can look at that map. That might help you to visualize what's going on. But they went kind of southeast from where they had been to Sukkot, which the best reconstruction is that Sukkot was an area. It was an area that was typically used by the nomadic peoples who were either coming into Egypt or leaving Egypt as kind of a stopping place, because Sukkot means tents. So they think it was just a place where people stopped temporarily who were either coming to Egypt or leaving Egypt. And it's to that area then that the Israelites first fled. So slightly south, southeast. Okay, verse 17. Now it came about when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and they return to Egypt. Hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God shall surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones from here with you. Then they set out from Sukkot and camped at Etan on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. There are three main routes, as I understand it, and some of the sources that I consulted don't all agree on this, but there are apparently three main routes by which someone might go from Egypt to Palestine. The first would be the way to the land of the Philistines. If you look on the map that I sent out, if you have it. Otherwise, you might want to look, and there's probably a map in your Bible. But this is a route that stays furthest north. That is to say, it kind of hugs the shoreline of the Mediterranean Sea. And that goes directly from Egypt, turns north when the shoreline turns north, up through what is now Gaza, and then goes into Palestine. That was the highway for traveling from Egypt to Palestine. It was well developed by the Egyptians. They used it quite often. And there were fortresses dotted along that route in various places, Egyptian fortresses that would guard it. And there were soldiers stationed at each of those fortresses. Some of those fortresses apparently had a special purpose. In Egyptian, as I understand it, every noun has what's called a determinative. It's a little particle that tells you what kind of thing this noun is describing. And some of these fortresses have a special determinative, and as best scholars can determine, that determinative means a fortress that serves as the ancient equivalent of passport control. That is to say, anybody coming by there has to stop and be examined by the soldiers at that fort and be given credentials or whatever before they can go on. It would appear that the route that the Israelites followed was designed to avoid having to go by one of those fortresses. They didn't want to have to go by passport control. The second route is a little bit further to the south. On the map that I sent out, that's called the Way to Shur. It's uncertain whether that name applies to this route, but there seems to have been a route, a middle route that goes through there. It's further south, and it heads north and goes through Beersheba and then into Palestine. This route is a little rougher. It's not as well developed. nor is it as fortified as the way to the land of the Philistines. But it would have a significant amount of traffic as well. The route that the Israelites are going to take is not really designed to be a route that goes from Egypt to Palestine, but you can get there by that route. This route goes mostly south along the eastern shoreline of the Red Sea, and that will go down to the tip of the Sinai Peninsula, and then later they're going to turn and go north. But this route that goes down to the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula was really primarily used by Egyptians and Egyptian slaves that were going down to the southern Sinai to work in the mines. That would be the primary reason why this route would be used. And it's only used in part of the year. The Israelites are going in spring, and if my memory serves me correctly, that would be too late for this to be used for mining purposes. They would do it in the cooler winter months rather than into the spring. So in all likelihood, they would not have encountered any traffic that time of year when they're going down that route. Okay, so it's that last route. They start out going from Ramses to Sukkot, and it looks like they're headed south, but in the next chapter, we'll see that they make an adjustment in their route. Okay, so those are the three possible routes. They are avoiding that first route because that is heavily fortified. And God says, don't go that way, lest the people change their minds when they see war and they return to Egypt. In other words, he doesn't want to put them in a situation where they're going to have to fight. Not now. This is too soon. He doesn't want to put them in a situation where they have to fight, so they're going to avoid the Egyptian armies. They're going to go a different route. So they aren't supposed to go by the easiest, most direct route. They have with them the bones of Joseph. If you'll recall, before Joseph died, he had his sons swear an oath that they would take his bones and take them back to the promised land when they went. I think that it's interesting that Joseph was a high-ranking official in Egypt, but I think Joseph could see that this was not going to be a good place for the people of Israel in the long run. And he knew the promises that had been given to Abraham, that Palestine, Canaan, had been given to the Israelites, and someday they would be going, and that's where Joseph's heart was. And so Joseph wanted his bones to be taken with them whenever they left Egypt and went to Canaan. God is accompanying the Israelites. By day, he's a pillar of cloud. By night, he's a pillar of fire. So there's always a presence there. I love this image because they could look up anytime they wanted and they could see, if it's at night, they could see the pillar of fire. If it's during the day, they can see the cloud. But they could look up anytime they wanted and see that it's there. But it's not right there. It's not right beside them. We see later in Numbers that they need scouts to help them find their route. So this pillar is not like a guide dog. It's not right there showing them every step. It is more generally there, and then they have to find their way. I love that image because it's so lifelike. That there's a sense in which God is always there and present, but he is removed enough that there's always that question, is he there? And yet he is. But his guidance is of such a nature that we need scouts. We need help kind of finding our way. We're finding our way. Even though he's out there, we know basically where we're headed. We still have to find our way, find our path. But that's the kind of guidance that God is providing. I don't know how to account for this phenomenon of the clouds and the pillar of fire. In Humphrey's book, he argues that Sinai is a volcanic peak, and at night they can see the flame, the fire from the volcano, and during the day they can see the plume of smoke from the volcano, and that those are the pillars that are being talked about. It doesn't seem to me that that can account for what we see in the narrative, that these clouds are, they are more showing the way than a volcano, which is stagnant, which is just standing there, would be able to do. So I don't know what these are, this pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire by night. Chapter 14 then, starting with verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pi-hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal Zephon, opposite it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And they did so. First of all, a comment about these place names, Migdol, Pi-hahiroth, and Baal Zephon. We don't know where any of those places are for sure. And as we go through the text, as they go through the wilderness, there are other places that are mentioned. And again, we don't know for sure what any of those locations are. It needs to be recognized that if you have nomadic people living in tents, first of all, not much is going to survive over time. It's not like a city where buildings are built out of stone and you can excavate those pieces of foundation and you can find coins that fell out of somebody's pocket or arrowheads or whatever. In this case, we don't know where any of those places are to even start digging. It's unlikely that there would be very many artifacts in any of those places, even if we did know the exact location of them. So it is difficult to identify these places, but I am basically following Hoffmeyer's suggestions, and he has located these, and on the map it shows you where they are, and next week I'll have another map that shows you more precisely where that little corner is where they turn. But that's part of our problem, is not knowing where they are. In verse 2, it says, tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Pi-hahiroth. What does it mean by turn back? And the best reconstruction that Hoffmeyer can make is that what's being talked about is a very significant change in direction. That they had started going mostly east and a little bit south, and now at this point, they've been directed by God to go almost directly north. And that's going to take them into an area where there are some sizable lakes. And you'll see on your map, there are some lakes up there. There are also some lakes down to the south before you get to the Red Sea. So in this depression that runs from the Red Sea up to the Mediterranean, there are a number of bodies of water. Now, those have been incorporated into the Suez Canal. So, God has told them, I want you to go north. So they turn north. That's not a very direct route, as you can tell by looking at the map. And as a result, the Pharaoh probably has scouts, some of his military, who are observing the movement of the Israelites as they're leaving Egypt. And he's informed that they have taken this odd turn. They were headed southeast. All of a sudden, they're going north. And Pharaoh concludes from this, they're lost. They don't know where they're going. Maybe within their group, there's a disagreement as to where they should go. Who knows what's going on? But they are in disarray. They don't know what they're doing. So Pharaoh sees that, and he decides, you know, this is an opportunity. And it's something that God had created, which is, I think, quite curious. God had created the impression that they were, and he's going to thereby get Pharaoh to go after them again. And we'll see that in the next section, verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people. And they said, what is this we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made his chariot ready, and took his people with him. And he took 600 select chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel, as the sons of Israel were going out boldly. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook them, camping by the sea, beside Pi-Hahiroth, in front of Baal-Zephon. So Pharaoh is in a situation where he's recognizing what a huge loss this is. He has lost an enormous amount of manpower, and he regrets it. Now he's thinking, oh, if I just had that back. And he sees the Israelites have lost their way, and he's thinking, this is the perfect opportunity to go and to bring them back. So that's what he does. He puts together an army, 600 select chariots and their drivers and the officers to command them, and he takes off to go to where the Israelites are, chase them down, and bring them back. Verse 10, and as Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. It's easy to understand what's happening here. Pharaoh with his army is coming, rushing to get them. The Israelites see them coming, and they say, oh no, we're dead. It's going to be easy for them to just wipe us out. And as a result, it says they cry out to God, but most of what they say is directed towards Moses. Moses, why did you bring us out here? Was there a shortage of graves in Egypt? We're all going to die. It is easy to look at the reactions of the Israelites as we go on, and this is not the last time that this will happen. It is easy to look at the Israelites and say, they were such fools. Why were they so faithless? But it seems to me that anyone who's thought about their own experience can identify with this very well and recognize that we all, in one way or another, fall into the same pattern. They are clearly exaggerating the danger. They say we're all going to be killed. That's highly unlikely. The Egyptians want them as slave labor. They're going to come and take them captive and take them back to Israel. So they've exaggerated the problem, and they've completely lost track of what it is that God has done for them up to now and the indications that God is with them and watching over them, including the clouds that are right there and the pillar of fire. They're overlooking all of that and just focusing on what a dire situation it is that they are in. Okay, so I've decided very cleverly to stop there with everyone in suspense, not knowing what's going to happen, with them pinned against the water on one side and the Egyptian army coming after them on the other side. I want to talk just a little bit about the importance of history. And this is a topic about which I could talk at much greater length. It's a topic that I think is important. It's certainly important to me. And I think that it is a topic that is particularly important and relevant in our time because we pay so little attention to history in our time. The past is extremely important. To neglect the past is to put ourselves at a huge disadvantage because the past is this rich resource which can help us to understand how things work. It's like a huge compendium of laboratory experiments with respect to human beings and how human beings act as a group. As a result, the past is critical for understanding the present. And it's also helpful in projecting the future. So to neglect it is at our detriment. I think everyone recognizes how important history is because we fight over it so much. What is it that happened in the past, and how are we going to characterize that? We all know that the way that that is characterized is going to have a huge impact on how people think. There is a huge tendency in all of us to want to manipulate the story of the past so that the hearers will think about the present in the way that the teller wants them to think about it. And it's because we all want to go back and tell the story of the past differently that, in my mind, we are all revisionist historians. We're all going back and wanting to change the way that story is told. We want to change it in a way that's more suitable to us. This is just a simple example. My father-in-law was involved in the sport of ski racing. He was a coach for the U.S. Olympic alpine team. And then he went on to help found professional downhill ski racing and do some other things. And we were visiting him recently, and he was all worked up because there were people that were writing about the beginning of the World Cup of skiing, and they were telling the story wrongly. Now, I don't know all the details of what they were getting wrong, but he was very energized about this because the people that were writing about what happened, they were people who weren't there and hadn't really talked to the people who were there, and yet they were writing authoritatively about what happened. And my father-in-law was very energized to get the record straight. The past matters. History matters. How that story is told matters. And it's important to note that there are all kinds of ways of manipulating the story told about the past. Keep in mind that you can tell a story about the past that is all factual and it be wrong. The illustration that always comes to mind when I talk about this is one from when my parents first moved to Eugene. Bought a house on a corner lot, and it didn't have any lawn, so we planted a lawn in the yard. And the day after we had planted it, we came outside, and there were deep grooves of bicycle tire tracks that went across the lawn. We all knew who the most likely person to have done this was. It was a boy by the name of Billy who lived next door. So my mom confronted him and said, "Billy, do you know how these tire tracks got in our yard?" And he said, "Yes, it was my sister's bicycle." That completely passes the fact check. It is completely false. It has been designed to be misleading as to what had actually happened. It is very possible to tell a story about the past that is entirely factual and entirely wrong. In order for history to be right, it needs to be true. And the way I envision this is the difference between a portrait and a caricature. A caricature and a portrait both retain the essential features of whatever it is, whatever the subject is. But a caricature gets them out of right proportion for its purposes. Historians do that all the time, getting things out of right proportion. So history needs to be truthful, but it also needs to be in right proportion, and being factual is not enough. Okay, and there's a lot more that I could say about history, and it's to the place now where people don't talk about history, they talk about narratives. And I get tired of hearing the word narratives because narrative has the connotation that this is one take, one way of understanding the past, of which there may be others, but they're all equally legitimate or whatever. But little interest in finding and taking seriously, retaining what actually happened, what is true and what is balanced. History is very important when we come to the Bible. Much of the Bible is history. A big chunk of the Bible, if not the majority, is historical narrative telling us what happened. Why the devotion to historical narrative? It's because one of God's main ways of revealing himself is to reach down into human history and to act. And we can see what he has done, we can see how people have responded to it, and we can see how God has responded to them. The Bible gives us that unique perspective in which we can sometimes see God's take on what's going on and his commentary on it. So there's much that we can learn from history about who God is. It's critical. But it's curious, God rarely acts overtly in history. It is relatively rare that God reaches in and acts in a way that we can see that was God's hand at work. And so those events are particularly important and need to be kept in mind. If we don't remember those, keep those in mind, it is easy for us to lose track of God's presence and what he's doing in reality. It's easy to just kind of keep our heads down and take the next step and lose complete track of the bigger picture and the reality of God and what he's doing. I've used this example before of chemistry, that this looks like it's a hard surface and that there's no space in it. But as a result of centuries of exploring the nature of matter, we now understand that this is mostly blank space. And that's a hard thing to reconcile with our experience because it really looks like it's a solid surface. But it's understanding the deeper complexities that help you to understand the nature of matter itself. And I would say the same is true of history, but it's understanding the deeper complexities that helps us to understand what is life all about, what is God up to, and what kind of God is he? God's actions in Egypt constitute one of those times when God reaches into human history and does something dramatic and overt. God tells people what he's going to do, the miracles that he is going to perform, and then he performs them, just as he had said that he would. And in so doing, he provides his people salvation out of the slavery that they have endured for 400 years. But most of history is without those kinds of events. Most of history is without clear indication that God is in control of things and doing what he said that he would do. And as a result, for much of our lives, we're going through without that kind of help. And it's in those times that we need to remember what it is that God did in history, what God did at the Passover, what God did at the Exodus. And it is phenomenal what he did. He brought his people out of Egypt after 430 years. And now what he's going to go on to do is take a people that have been fully Egyptianized culturally, he's going to take them and reshape them and make them into a people that are his people, that are devoted to him. Amazing, an amazing thing that he's doing here. So the Passover was a huge deal, and that's why it needs to be remembered. God instituted the annual celebration to be held forever so that every generation would pass on to the next one what it was that happened. And I think what he's intending is that true history be passed on. Pass on eyewitness accounts. Tell your sons what actually happened and have them pass that on to their sons. And it's by that means then that the nation of Israel is supposed to keep the memory of the Passover alive to help them to make it through those stretches of time, long stretches of time, when God seems to be absent. Now, I've wondered why it would be the Passover that would be the celebration and not what's coming up, the crossing of the Red Sea. There's a sense in which that's the bigger, more dramatic miracle. And the only answer I can think of is the Passover is just full of symbols that are going to be relevant later on in history. So the Passover becomes the more content-laden of the miracles that God performed. What is at stake here? The argument that Moses is building here is that you know that God is the master of the universe that he claims to be, that he is capable of working on your behalf, regardless of what the obstacles, regardless of what the opponents might be. He is capable of working on behalf of his people, and he shows a readiness to save them, to deliver them out of oppression and slavery. That's what is to be remembered. And we know that that is true because of what God did in Egypt. That means that if God didn't do that in Egypt, we don't know that those things are true. It is important from the biblical perspective, from the way that Moses is writing this, it is important that this is historical fact. If it's not historical fact, what are we doing here? It's very similar to the argument that Paul makes Is it 1 Corinthians where he talks about if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, if you can show me bones of Jesus' body, then we have no basis to hope that we will be resurrected from the dead. That's critical. That historical fact is critical to our belief. If that is not a historical fact, then why believe? And I think we have a similar kind of thing here, that Passover is another one of those historical events on which the Bible is building a case. And if that did not happen, then the things that are built on that, we have no basis for believing those things. Go find another basis if you want to believe them. Okay. Comments? Questions?
David, I just want to ask you, when you're talking about sacrifice of the firstborn, like with a large animal, it could be redeemed. Did the animal that was doing the redeeming also have to be firstborn, or just a substitute?
No. My understanding is it just had to be a suitable sacrifice. It has to be clean, and it has to be without blemish, that sort of thing.
And I really like what you said about history. There's a really good example. I can't think of the painter now, but it deals with Napoleon putting Maximilian on the throne in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And there's a painting that shows the French army shooting him when it wasn't the French army. But it's a lie that very clearly shows the truth, that the reason why he was killed was because the French had left out.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm getting at?
Yep. Yep.
Shortly after the story of the burning bush, there's a less well-known story where God tries to murder Moses. I mean, that's what it says. Because he neglected to circumcise his son. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about circumcision earlier with the Passover, that anybody who identifies with Israel through the method of circumcision is then permitted to enter into that particular feast. Mm-hmm. I guess I just want to know what is up with the God of the Bible's morbid preoccupation with the male organ and removing flesh that the creator of the universe put there in the first place. Nowadays, it's a hygienic thing, or at least we think it is. But in the Bible, it's theological, it's ceremonial. He tries to kill people if they don't do it. It's pretty fucking morbid, if I must say. To really take that seriously as the Word of God is incredibly difficult. And to talk about it in a blasé way that is just sort of passing over how serious and intense that is and how weird that is, it's just incredible to me.
Mm-hmm. I would grant that it's weird. And that's not the only weird thing that we run into in the Bible. I'm not sure if it, in all times of history, it would have seemed as weird as it does to us. I just don't know. Circumcision, I'm confident, is full of symbolism. What all of that symbolism is, I don't know. But it's interesting that the sign that God chose to indicate who is part of this people and who isn't is one that is both intimate and painful. It costs you something to do this. And I think that's not accidental. I think that's by intent, by plan. And I suspect that part of the symbolism is related to what it says in Deuteronomy when it says, God says he's going to circumcise their hearts. That there is, circumcision is symbolic of the removal of a kind of thickness that renders insensitive. And what God says he's going to do is circumcise the heart. That is, he's going to remove that which renders the heart less sensitive to God himself. So I think there's deep symbolism that's going on there. Why God would do it that way, I don't know. I don't know. And I grant it's weird.
David, every time in the Old Testament they talk about sacrifice or giving the firstborn, and I guess I'm looking at it practically as somebody who has livestock. If you've ever had livestock slaughtered on your place,
right,
you're dealing with a mess. Even when all the offal is taken away, you still have to, you have blood, and you have to, even washing and taking care of it the best that you can, you still have a stinky mess. And in this particular case, on the firstborn, especially if you're talking about sheep, if you've looked out at even the pastures around here, there can be thousands of sheep in one pasture. And probably 10% of the females each year are replaced, and so that wouldn't be unusual. Mm-hmm. And so you're looking at a not just, you got to keep track of everything, for one thing. I mean, there's ways you can do it, but it's going to take a lot of work no matter what you're
computers,
doing.
Computers, that's what computers are for.
Yeah, and then top of it, if you give it to the Lord, does it mean it has to be sacrificed? Because then if you're taking 10% of the animals, say, the lambs, and especially if it has to be done during the Passover festival time, mm-hmm. my word, what do they do with it? Is it the main thing is just to sacrifice it, and it doesn't matter what if it's being used or not? Or I know it's supposed to be given to the Levites or something, but there's only so much that the pastoral leadership can handle at one time. And I don't know if you've ever thought of that, but every mm-hmm. time I mm-hmm. see the numbers that are involved in sacrificing, it's just kind of, how did this happen?
Right. I have thought about this, and I've read some books about what happens at the temple. And the temple was an extremely busy place. There were a lot of priests, and then you have Levites as well, so priests and Levites. There were a lot of them that were involved, that worked 24 hours a day on the Temple Mount. Part of it's cleaning up, because you're right, you sacrifice that many animals and you've got a huge mess, and that has to be cleaned up. So they're doing all kinds of things, chopping wood, getting the wood ready for the altar, all that sort of thing, carrying water. There are all kinds of things that they're doing. I don't remember what happens with the animals that are the firstborn that are sacrificed, but there are three things that can happen to an animal. One is that a whole burnt offering means that it is burnt completely. There aren't very many situations where there is a whole burnt offering. The next is an offering that once it has been sacrificed, it's been killed and then put on the altar, then it is given to the priests or the Levites, and they eat it, and they have to eat it on the Temple Mount. The third thing that can happen is the animal is sacrificed, put on the altar, and I don't know whether it's seared or exactly what they do, but then that is given to the family. Sometimes they eat that on the Temple Mount, and sometimes they can take that home with them. So most of the sacrifices end up being eaten by someone, all except for the whole burnt offerings. Now, did I get most? Are there some other?
Yeah, I just didn't know that if the animal had to be sacrificed, or if when it says to give the firstborn, I mean, there's a monetary value of that.
Yes.
That could be exchanged, you know, for the animal, or if it just, you think it means that the animal has to be sacrificed, period.
I think it's the animal needs to be sacrificed, period. But that would, someone would end up eating that, probably. Someone would end up eating that, so it's not like, because I'm pretty sure these are not whole burnt offerings. Okay. All right, thanks.